You are now entering the spoiler zone. The following podcast contains explicit plot details and pockets of profanity. You have been warned. The Exton Moss Experiment. Adventures in wine and space with Simon Exton and Ken Moss.
Hello everyone, and a very warm welcome to another edition of the Exton Moss Experiment. I'm Ken Moss.
I'm Simon Exton.
It's hello to the 14th Doctor. And in rapid succession, hello to the 15th Doctor.
And oh god, it's you again, to Donna.
These were three special episodes of Doctor Who that ran from the 25th of November to the 9th of December 2023, starring David Tennant and Catherine Tate, and written by Russell T. Davies. Before we launch into a televisual feast, we need a drinky. It's time to whip out the new tonic screwdriver and open up the gin. This time we are drinking Eden Mill Love Gin. It's 40%, and the info bollock says, founded in 2012 in our home of St Andrews, Scotland, Eden Mill is committed to using only the finest botanicals combined with traditional distillation techniques and modern innovation. As Scotland's first single-site distillery and brewery, making gin, whiskey and beer, Eden Mill Spirit is created by our distillers in copper pot stills and exhibits a wide range of flavours from botanical sourced from the local area, as well as from around the world. We have earned our reputation for producing gins of exceptional taste and character, with an unwavering dedication to quality. A lightly sweet pink gin, taste of rhubarb spice and sweet strawberries with vanilla, finishing with green apple citrus and a hint of rose water. Nose, touch of warm spice berries, strawberry, raspberries and sweet vanilla and green fruits, finishing with a very delicate citrus pink grapefruit and floral rose petals. Well, there's certainly the kitchen sink been thrown in there. There's a lot of flavours that I personally am fond of. Let's find out.
It's a bit pink.
There's a vaguest pink tinge to it. Nasal appraisal?
It smells a bit pink.
Bugger all, really.
It has that sort of vaguely berry-ish flavour that you get with pink gins.
It is very vague, though.
On the nose.
Oh, well, kilts up, you English bastards. Dive into this.
That's really quite nothingy.
I'm really glad it's not just me. I thought my taste buds were playing up.
It's got a little bit of a junipery tingle to it.
It's like you get little sort of ghosts of flavour and then they disappear. I've had a touch of the rose. I've had a touch of the apple, but they're there and they've gone. I tell you what I am getting from this. A tingle right at the sinus. But I've got to admit to being massively disappointed.
Doesn't stand out at all. Couldn't pick it out of a lineup. Three.
It's a three from me as well. It's a perfectly nice drink. It's just nothing exceptional. And it's such a shame because the list of flavours and ingredients in there, they're all favourites. But it's like a lot of things. If you hurl everything... Well, exactly. It is kitchen sink syndrome. You hurl everything into something, they do tend to cancel each other out.
Sad but true.
Well, before we launch into a review of each particular episode, Dr. Exton, how do you feel? In terms of just the general feel, the vibe of the start of a new era.
Oh, for God's sake. You're goading me to say unpleasant things about Chris Chibnall, aren't you? Well, fuck it. If that's the way we're going to go, that's the way we're going to go. I'm really, really relieved that Crayon Boy is out of the way. Really relieved.
It really is like Doctor Who's back. Now, it's not universal praise on my part that I do have a couple of niggles, but on the whole, what a relief. This is Doctor Who, how it should be done, with a massive budget and a competent executive producer. I am very, very happy. Now, we have three episodes to go out. Ordinarily, we would do full commentaries, but we're not doing this time. We're just doing digests.
Because we're lazy. We're very, very lazy.
Yes, and somebody's got to edit these things, and honestly...
It ain't me.
Whip, whip, whip. The first one was broadcast on the 25th of November, and it's called The Star Beast. The 14th Doctor runs into Donna Noble and her family. A spaceship crashes. Meeting with unit scientist Shirley Ann Bingham, the Doctor questions why he resembles his 10th incarnation and why destiny is converging on Donna. Written by Russell T. Davis, from a story by Pat Mills and Dave Gibbons, this would broadcast on the 25th of November 2023 to an audience of 7.6 million viewers.
Sometimes I think there's something missing. Like I had something lovely. And it's gone. I lie in bed thinking, what have I lost?
There was this friend called Donna Noble. I had to wipe her memory to save her life.
No!
If she remembers me, she will die. So what happens next? The spaceship crashes right in front of her. It's like she's drawing us in.
What the hell? We've got a bloody Martian in the shed!
Don't look! Meet me!
Here we go again. I don't believe in destiny, but if destiny exists, then it is heading for Donna Noble.
Who are they?
Monsters.
Why does it have to be this?
Dr. Exton, what did you think?
It was very shiny. There was a lot of good stuff in it. It was really nice to see Tennant back, although he didn't seem quite comfortable. He didn't seem as though he quite worked out how he was going to play it.
Really? Did you think that?
Yeah, it was almost sort of, do I play it old school? Do I put a bit of maturity into it? Do I make him a bit more miserable? In this first one, it didn't quite gel. And, you know, post-regeneration, you don't really expect a Doctor to gel. And for all we're getting an old Doctor Who actor back, he's supposed to be playing a new character. So I don't really have a problem with that. But in that first one, it was all a bit sort of all rabbit in the headlights.
Now, I've got to admit that I thought that his performance was splendid. I thought that it was...
Oh, I think it's splendid. I just don't think it was...
Not the performance per se. I just thought that he'd got basically a more mature and well-worn, maybe travel-weary 10th Doctor. And that's what I got right from the start, almost to the point of being doer. But yes, I can see where you're coming from, but I did quite like that his take on the 14th Doctor, it was very inevitably very 10th Doctor, but it was just enough different to be a different Doctor.
Yeah, fair enough. And Catherine Tate has at some point had some acting lessons.
You're a harsh bastard.
Not convinced she finished the course, but she's had some. You know my problem with Donna.
Yes.
Or you know my problem with the portrayal of Donna.
Mm.
She's a well-written character, but she's predominantly written as a caricature. And a comedian will do better than anybody else at a caricature. The problem comes when you want something with a bit more nuance. And there wasn't anything in this script that called for nuance from anybody, because it was a comic book script. It was very clearly a comic book script. It was four colour through and through. They made no bones about it. I didn't particularly like the fact that for the 60th anniversary, we didn't have an original story. I think there could have been a little more imagination gone into it. I was never wild keen on a lot of the weekly and monthly comic strips. I think just an awful lot of them weren't terribly good. And the Star Beast is one of the better ones. It was a Dave Gibbons, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And I just thought it had been called The Star Beast. I didn't realise that it was actually basically a retread of a comic strip.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Well, there you go.
I think in the comic, the Meep is revealed as the villain earlier on.
I have no problem with the first one being a little bit fluffy and comic book. I actually think that for fans of the comics, it's a nice kiss.
It would be if it was an episode in the middle of a series where it could just fit in. But this wasn't. This was front and center. This is what we've been waiting for. This is the big dramatic. Russell T. Davis is coming back. This is the 60th anniversary. I didn't want an adaptation of something. I wanted something. I wanted a Day of the Doctor.
Yeah. In terms of being an anniversary special, I mean, all three of them, I'll be honest, did just feel like standard episodes. So none of them had that anniversary special feel. It's a different way of celebrating a big anniversary, but none of them had the Day of the Doctor feel or the Five Doctors feel or probably the Three Doctors feel that we've probably come to expect. I suspect there'll be a few people out there very disappointed that none of the old Doctors pop back in for a cameo. I'm not entirely convinced that we needed them. I mean, there were enough Doctors floating about this year, let's be honest. However, just in terms of, and I know you couldn't give a toss about this, but in terms of canonicity, I think it would have been nice for the fans of the comics if it hadn't been so largely obvious that the Doctor's not met Meepkind before, or it doesn't appear that he remembers it, and I think it would have just been a nicer kiss if it would have been, I've met your sort before, kind of thing. Even if it's not Beep specifically. Because he wasn't, or he, she, they, whatever, the Meep, wasn't named except in one cough and a spit over an explosion. I am Beep of all the Meeps. And that was it. So for myself, as someone who's never been into the comic strips, it was, I know it's out there, the lore is out there, but I think that for the comic fans, it would have been nicer if it had been, we've been here before in a former incarnation, without being that explicit.
The whole evil in a beautiful disguise thing is so old-fashioned, it's practically a cliche. And I mean, in terms of Doctor Who, it dates all the way, what, Galaxy 4?
Yeah, I suppose, but it's not been done a lot in Doctor Who.
Perhaps because it's a bit obvious.
But again, for somebody coming to this who's never seen Beep the Meep, for someone who's coming to this who's never seen the Wrath Warriors, or even knows who they are, on screen, the logical thing is that they're going to be the other way around. So me and you are coming to it with a bit of a handicap, really. We already know what the end's going to be, whereas the vast majority of the viewers won't. So we have to look at it sometimes through the eyes of the not we. Basically, this is a reboot of the series, Disneyfying things, trying to get new viewers on board. And judging from the overnights, they've massively succeeded. They've comfortably doubled the audience from the last season.
Yeah, but didn't the viewing figures drop down for the second episode?
Oh, not enough. They've all been about 7.5.
Okay.
So that's no small beer these days, 7.5.
Absolutely. Although for the amount of hype leading up to it.
Yeah, I mean, we can pick holes in or pore over viewing figures, but either way, they're a massive increase on what they were.
And massively improved on what they were.
What, you mean the episodes themselves?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
I just wish they'd come up with an original story because they had long enough. They had the skill and talent to be able to do it. They had really good characters going in. The unit team, I liked a lot. Donna's family, I liked.
Yes, let's address the elephant in the room. Yasmin Finney. I'm going to get it right out. She's not a very good actress. I was watching this with Paul Lyles-Rush. We made a night of it. And we both commented that she's a bit wooden. And then there's even a line at the end of the episode where Donna says, she's a terrible actress. She can't act. I don't know how to tell her. Yeah.
And Catherine Tate is saying that.
Well, I'm going to leave that there. That's more your take than mine. But my main beef with Rose, nothing to do with the fact that she's trans or she's a trans character. It's the fact that writers have no idea what to do with trans characters, except for them to say that they're trans all the time. Is that it?
You know, I'm a fairly ardent supporter of the trans community.
It has been mentioned once or twice. Yeah.
I'm very glad that there was a trans character. I'm very glad it wasn't shied away from in the way that the horrible mess of Sleep No More was. I just wish that she'd had another character trait. It was her only character trait. And I do get that for trans people and for any kind of queer people, then life is one constant run of coming out to different people and different people and different people. But you can talk about other things, particularly with your family.
I mean, there were certain things I thought was quite sensitively handled, like when Sylvia was having that awkward conversation in the kitchen.
Yes.
I've no problem with that. I think that's a perfectly normal, real-life conversation that is useful to drop into dramas where there's a trans character. I think that's actually quite helpful.
And I think the dead-naming sequence, because I know they've had a lot of criticism for that, I think that was an important thing. That demonstrated the kind of mindless bigotry and the damage that it can do.
Oh, I agree entirely. And these are little nods and kisses that I have no problem with at all.
If she just had something else to do other than...
I'm trans. That was very predictable, wasn't it? You just assumed that it's a he. Have you never heard of pronouns? And that whole bollocks about being non-binary at the end. Now, I'm going to say this and then bottom the argument out, because it's just... there's so much more to talk about these specials, but... for people of my demographic, not necessarily very au fait with the whole trans thing, desperately trying to understand, not trying to tread on toes, but not fully grasping, the whole episode had been spent building up the fact that she'd transitioned from Jason into Rose. It was hard work, etc., etc. You know, she's beautiful, she's this. And then at the end, a horrible crowbar... just a way to get the binary scene from Journey's End into a non-binary sequence. So all of a sudden this trans character, she isn't a she at all. She's a they, and she's non-binary. So fuck me, tight. The rules have changed again, and we're supposed to be kind of fine with this and not question it and not ask questions about it, because otherwise we're transphobic bigots. This is the problem that I would suggest the vast majority of people have. Not everybody is au fait with trans terminology, trans culture, if you like. We don't know every damn thing. But this puts people in a situation where they're forced to ask, and by asking or commenting on it, you immediately get the, you're a transphobic bigot. And it just invites conflict. I love the fact that the Doctor Donna had been split by her having a child. I thought that was a great way out of it. Brilliant, fantastic. But what was all that non-binary bollocks? And then, you wouldn't know as a male-presenting Time Lord. The whole episode, he was asking why he'd got that face. He'd clearly not chosen to be a man with that face. And yet it was spat at him as if it was, well, you chose to be a man. I detested that whole sequence. The whole episode was peppered with things which I chided Chibnall for. I just wish it wasn't so antagonistic towards basically white men. I think that was the undercurrent, and it's not helping.
I didn't notice, and it doesn't worry me. I think you're possibly being a little bit sensitive there.
Possibly. I just don't think that ramming
little,
this...
little touch on the snowflakey side.
Oh, I've got my badge.
It's not all you got.
Listen, I've got cream for that. This was
Jesus,
the...
you need a sandblaster.
I'm determined to carry on with this. I'm just not sure that this... it was
well done, you.
Slightly heavy-handed, the way that certain things were pushed. I don't think that it was done in the best way. Doctor Who, throughout the ages, has always sort of drip-fed political messages. And I don't like calling them political messages, but you know what I mean. It's always had a tone, a message, a moral value to just to impart to the audience. And it's always been drip-fed so that you don't even know it's happening, really. It's just gone a little bit the other way. It's a little bit tap full on.
I have no problem with things being a little more obvious. I actually have no problem with things being obviously said. And I have no problem with some of the trans messages from Rose's character being pretty heavy duty, because things like dead naming shouldn't be subtle. They should smack you between the eyes as wrong and uncomfortable. So that I don't have a problem with.
Yep, that's fair enough. Yes.
The Sylvia scene where she's uncomfortable and she knows that she fucks it up on occasion and she desperately tries not to, and she's desperately trying to do the right thing by Rose. That was lovely.
Oh, no, absolutely.
That was wonderfully done. I just really wish that Rose had had another personality trait. And I think it's a bit unfair to say Yasmin Finney puts in a poor performance, because if you're only given one thing to focus on and talk about, it's not going to come across great, no matter how good an actress she is. I've never seen her in anything else, so I don't know how good or otherwise an actress she is. But I think it's a bit of the Jodie Whittaker syndrome, in that she wasn't given the best opportunity for things to work with.
Possibly, but there was a spaceship crashing at the beginning of the episode, and it was like she was reading it off an idiot board. Oh, there's a spaceship crashing. And it was really sort of, have another go at it, love. But anyway, I don't want to focus on that, because there's so much more to focus on. Other characters, though, we have Shirley Ann Bingham. We have an interesting scientific advisor character again. I hope we see a lot more of her. You're less impressed, aren't you?
No, I thought she was great. I didn't like the tricked out wheelchair, to be honest. I thought that was gimmicky and James Bond.
I loved it for that reason.
I would have far preferred it if, instead of little rocket launchers in her wheelchair at the touch of a button, she'd just reached behind her and pulled out a great big fuck off gun and said, leave this bit to me.
Yeah, but if she'd done that, he would have rounded on her, because he doesn't like guns. Rocket launchers, fine, no problem, but he doesn't like guns. But all in all, I am glad that, and this is one bit where, you know, I know that there'll be people out there that don't know, person in a wheelchair, another tick. She was an interesting character, and this is what I've always said about people that are dropped in. Bill Potts, the obvious example, black lesbian, but she was fucking marvellous. She was an interesting character, and that's where Shirley Ann Bingham scores, because she's this interesting, wanted to be a scientist, read all the files on you, just knows what's going on, wants to know what's going on, and then there's a flight of stairs. Right, just fuck off up the stairs and investigate. Don't make me the problem. Just get. There's none of that, woe is me, I'm in a wheelchair. I loved that. It was just there. And I think that's what characters like that should be.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I thought she was great. I've always liked Kate Lethbridge-Stewart.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Donna's family was marvellous. Throughout this episode, Donna was good, because she wasn't really given any emotional heavy lifting to do. And so it was the Donna stroppy caricature that she does brilliantly well.
Overall, what do we think of the ep?
I enjoyed it. I thought it was good, but it was disappointing for a 60th anniversary special.
Yeah, I'll second that. I've gone into this looking at them rather than expecting a special. I've gone in looking at, well, they're celebrating the 60th anniversary with an entire Doctor's era. So let's look at it that way. So I was slightly less disappointed, I think, but I wasn't aware that it was a retread of a comic strip. I did think there were tremendous flaws. The biggest thing was the Rose letdown. I was expecting so much more from her. I did hope to see Wilf. We didn't get Wilf in this. And I've since found out that he only managed to film one scene, which was, I didn't realise. But the standout moment for me, end of the episode. Oh, the TARDIS.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Now that, boys and girls, is a TARDIS. It's rocketed up the rankings to number 3 straight away. McGann is still first. Hartnell's is still second. That is gorgeous. Oh, I got the tingle when they opened the doors, to the point where I didn't hear any of the conversation. As soon as he opened the door and you saw the tantalising glimpse inside, I didn't hear a word of dialogue they were saying outside. And, oh, it's beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful. And then Donna goes and blows it up, which takes us very neatly into the next episode, which is Wild Blue Yonder. The TARDIS crash lands on a spaceship at the edge of the known universe. Sensing hostile action, the TARDIS dematerialises, stranding the Doctor and Donna, who begin exploring the ship, finding it abandoned. After locating the bridge, they're confronted by a pair of unknown entities from outside the known universe. Broadcast on the 2nd December 2023, written by Russell T. Davis, this attracted 6.9 million viewers.
It goes away.
There's something on this ship that's so bad the TARDIS ran away.
Yes.
Hello? Life signs.
Who are they?
Donna! save your life this time.
I'm fairly sure I know what you're going to say about this. You're going to say that nothing happens, aren't you?
No, I'm not. I'm going to say it's a Solaris ripoff. I'm going to say that it was a massive example of, look, we've got these marvelous special effects, so we don't need to worry too much about the story they're going around. And I'm going to say I was disappointed with it. But I'm not going to say nothing happens because it's not Waters of Mars.
Oh, you're going to keep sticking the knife into Waters of Mars, aren't you? On balance, I've seen this twice now. It is a triumph of style over substance. There's not actually a lot of meat on the bones, but it looks glorious. And as a showcase for, I would say, probably how things are going to look in the future, they've done a good job. That's a good trailer. Now, as a two-hander, which is what it basically is, I did really enjoy it. I agree, it's a totally unoriginal idea. You've got them stranded on a ship in the middle of nowhere, the edge of the universe stuff, drifting in deep space, lost. Oh, look, there's doppelgangers on board. It's all been done before.
Yeah, and the whole having to work out who the doppelgangers are. Yeah, that was interesting. It went on too long. Maybe I missed it, but there is no explanation as to why this happened, apart from weird shit happens when you're at the end of the universe. And again, 60th anniversary, I wanted a little bit more thought and plotting.
On the whole, I think that the three episodes are all, even the one that's to come, they're not the best episodes of Doctor Who they've ever been, but they all look great. With that in mind, I do think that in terms of a 60th anniversary, they do let themselves down. Or maybe that's it. Maybe they just get away with it because they look so beautiful and you've got, ooh, shiny new Doctor, and you're too busy focusing on other things to worry about the fact that there's not an awful lot to hang what remains of the story on. But somehow the episode hangs together. There's enough little bits in it to keep you hooked. There's a nod back to the Flux, and there's a nod back to the Timeless Child, but done in such a way that it's ambiguous. And since nobody understood the Flux to start with, Russell T. Davis has got a hell of a job on his hand trying to explain it. So what he does is explain it by not explaining it. And therefore, somehow, it makes more sense than it did. There's a nice little emotional outburst from the Doctor when he realises that he's opened his soul to this thing, who he thinks is Donna, who's just about to bare his soul that he's missed his friend terribly. And then he realises he's been tricked and he's angry about it. And then you can't work out whether he's angry about having been tricked or whether he's angry about the fact that that's how he's feeling inside and he can't let it out. It's just full, it's peppered with little moments, little emotional moments. And this is what I've always wanted from Doctor Who for quite a long time, is little moments to breathe. And I think this allowed that.
The other thing is saying, oh, Donna is so important to me that I searched her out through time and space, blah, 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 blah. And then he can't work out who the real Donna is and takes the false one onto the TARDIS and then goes, oh, fuck. I can understand dramatically why they do that and it's Donna left behind and then rescued at the last minute. But it's not actually a particularly good optic for him in that he can't tell her from the fake one, when they've spent the entire episode working out who's the fake and who isn't.
Yeah, I can see that, although to be fair to the Doctor in that, it was fairly difficult to work out either of those answers. If I'd asked that question about Mrs. Bean to somebody, why is it funny, and they'd said, it just is, I'd probably have thought that too. There were little nods to the past. I love the new Sonic. Well, I love the 14th Doctor's Sonic very much. I also love there was a little nod back to the Hads.
Yeah, I really wish they'd give the sonic screwdriver a rest, because basically it's become a tricorder and it's become a plot explanation device.
Oh, I must admit, I wasn't mad keen on the fact that it could draw bulletproof glass, because that now you've got an all-purpose get-out clause for any dangerous situation in future.
And actually, have you seen the 15th Doctor's Sonic?
I'm afraid I have. I'm not a fan.
It really does. It looks like a game controller, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's basically a Sky remote, yes.
And, you know, if he's going to start carrying a tricorder, he might as well start carrying something that's going to look like a tricorder.
So while Blue Yonder In the rankings, where are we placing this in the three?
It's probably my least favourite. It looked really nice. It doesn't really have a plot, and what plot it does have, it ripped off Solaris.
I agree with you. I did, for some reason, and I shouldn't, logically, I did prefer it to the Starbeast. I think because it had that real dark edge to it. Again, what you're saying is true. It's not an original story. It's not an original dark edge. But it's something that I think Doctor Who does very well. And I think when Doctor Who is darker, it's better than when it's lighter. I have always preferred the serious Doctor Who's and the Midnights and the Satan Pits. I've always preferred it when there's a real danger. So this is probably two in my rankings. But moving on, we round off the trilogy with The Giggle. In 1925 Soho, an assistant to television inventor John Logie Baird makes a purchase at a toy shop owned by the Toymaker. In the present day, the Toymaker causes havoc around the world and faces off against the Doctor and Donna. This was broadcast on the 9th of December 2023, written by Russell T. Davis. And the overnights are again in the 7-point-odd million viewers.
And I've got a memory. After a very long time, something's coming back.
Kate Lethbridge Stewart!
What do we do this time, Doctor? How do we fight the human race?
Something entered this world.
Oh, but he is recognizing me.
Who is he?
The one who waits.
Open fire!
Why does it have to be this?
Your fight is with me!
Worldwide premiere.
Dr. Exton, what did you think?
I wasn't particularly looking forward to this because the Toymaker isn't a favourite villain. The audio of the Celestial Toymaker is dull. I think the surviving episode is really dull. I wasn't sure why the Toymaker had been chosen. Now, as you get towards the end of the episode, it becomes obvious why the Toymaker has been chosen. And it was a really nice nod to the past to have the colourised footage of William Hartnell and Michael Gough there when David Tennant is first explaining who the Toymaker is. I thought that bit was just beautiful.
Any colourised footage is going to get me excited, as we'll come on to in a future podcast. They were very, very brief, the colourised bits, but what a lovely nod back to the past.
Yeah.
I am entirely with you. I think the Toymaker is a bit of a one-trick pony. And the problem
Well,
is,
I was talking about the Toymaker in the William Hartnell series.
Oh, no, that's, for me, probably the dullest story of the original run. I've never been gripped by the Celestial Toymaker. I know it's coming out on animation. Good luck, Who fans. I hope everybody laps it up and we sell lots and lots of Blu-rays and DVDs. I still can't get around the fact I think it's very, very dull.
Yes.
I mean, there's elements of the Toymaker in this. There's real danger to. There's this completely indestructible villain. I'm slightly concerned by the fact that for all the, what's the word? Politically correct casting that we're doing, and we must shy away from this, this, and this. There is another moustache-twirling German villain, yeah? I think that's a little bit of a backward step. I wasn't entirely sure what the hell the accent was all about or why. Maybe that was a flourish that Neil Patrick Harris put in. Don't know. It's not important. Move on. But if you're going to, you know, clean up your act, that's not a great progressive step. I just think that at the end, to defeat him with a game of catch, you were expecting something else. After all that had gone before. So, again, the Toymaker was there really as a hook to hang the rest of it on.
Yeah, although they did bait that particular hook right at the beginning when they first met him in the shop, when he was talking about the ball being the first game.
Oh, no, it was all very cleverly written. I'm not knocking the circular nature of how it ended up being that. It was just that for all the devastation that the Toymaker could have wrought, And, you know, you're just faced with somebody. The corridor scene with the doors.
Yeah, it was a bit God complex.
It was very God complex. But again, you're faced with somebody. The rules don't apply in the toy maker's world. There was a real genuine, how the hell do we get out of this? And then for it to be defeated with something as logical as a game of... It just, I mean, it's a niggle because you're picking apart an episode that isn't there to have a big bad villain. It's there to reintroduce characters. Mel. Oh, I got the massive tingle from that. I wasn't expecting it. I was expecting her next year. So if she's going to be part of the UNIT team, there was a kiss back to Sabalom Glitz and how she'd got back there. The whole thing was just peppered with nods back to the past.
I thought Neil Patrick Harris's portrayal was fantastic. Yeah, the Germanic accent, yeah, it goes along with the Nutcracker soldier thing, but was a slightly odd choice. I loved the piss-taking bit in the theatre about the ridiculous deaths of the Moffat companions. The doctor was coming out with the, oh, but she lives on in a puddle or she lives on in her final heartbeat. And he just turned around and said, oh, well, that's all right then.
Did you notice, though, how Graham, Ryan and Yaz weren't included?
Well, because they didn't have ridiculous death scenes that were retconned instantly.
I did think of you straight away, actually. Yeah, it was very much, look at how immortal the companions are. You've said this over and over, that they are fucking immortal.
And you know what? Companions always have been. You've always known the companions aren't going to come to any harm. So don't pretend they're going to be. Don't have this ridiculous, oh, it's the death of who she was. Don't have the, we'll give you this amazing emotional death and then resurrect you in a puddle. Or you can live 1,000 years in the gap between heartbeats. Oh, utter dog shit. That was always driven. I did like that piss take about that. The giggle was by far my favourite of the three, by far. I thought the toy maker worked very well. I thought he put in a superb performance.
Oh, yes. And I hope that we see him again because the door has now been left open.
I really hope we don't. I hope it's this is a big bad that has been defeated and got rid of and not just brought back, because it'd be the Weeping Angels. It'd be the law of diminishing returns. Every time he comes back, it will be that little bit weaker.
Actually, when you put it that way, yes.
Can only possibly be defeated by having two doctors working together. And to go from that to another example of Villain of the Week, no. I hope he doesn't come back in the same way as I wish that the Weeping Angels had never come back after Blink.
Now, we get to The Regeneration. It's different, I'll give you that. And it opens up a lot of doors. We've had our first bi-generation, whereby the Doctor regenerates and physically splits in two. What do we think?
It's an interesting way of doing things. It was definitely an interesting way of finishing off the Toymaker, having built him up to be this monumental universe-bending god, effectively, that it needed two Doctors to be able to defeat him. I think I would have preferred it if one of the Doctors had been sacrificed into defeating him. So if Shuti Gatwa had chucked the ball and David Tennant had rugby tackled the Toymaker off the edge of the carrier so that he couldn't catch it and they both fell to their death.
Yeah, but the problem with that is Big Finish wouldn't be able to do a spin-off.
Cry me a fucking river. No, I think that would have been better. I don't like the Doctor sitting and playing Happy Families until he's needed for plot reasons.
For me, and I'm sure I'm not the only person to have thought this, purely coincidentally, I've been listening to Stranded, the Eighth Doctor series, and it's basically the Eighth Doctor on Earth without a TARDIS. That's not been done before. But he's bored out of his skull. Now, for all the... And I think it was beautifully done, the whole, you're tired, you're knackered, you're worn out, just retire, mate. Here's your opportunity. It's clear that that's not what's going to happen and that off-screen there's going to be adventures, etc., etc. I do think it opens a lot of doors for plot resolution. The one that's always pissed me off, I've got to be honest, is the curator. And that all of a sudden gives a nice, tidy explanation for the curator. Because if this is a doctor that's retired, then that would be lovely. Because all of a sudden you've got then An open door for old doctors to come back in future, no matter how old they are, as the curator. This periodical interloper, not all the time, otherwise you diminish the magic, but this version of the doctor that helps periodically the odd nudge in the right direction in the background without being part of the main plot.
Yeah, except that it will be, as soon as you have a plot that's a bit too difficult to work out, or you've got a lazy writer who'll come along and say, oh, well, I've got this complicated plot that the Doctor can't get out of. So there's one of his other selves in the background who is there and just sorts things out, opens up the door, and then gives a little wave to the Doctor on his way out. And it, no.
Yeah, but that's down to a good executive producer to turn around and say, no, you don't. And I don't think Russell T. Davies would allow that wave of the magic wand. That's not to say he's not done the Deus Ex Machina.
Who's going to come after him?
Mark Gatiss, obviously.
Oh, dear God, no.
Nick Briggs?
Fucking hell.
Chris Chibnall could pop back for a second slice of the pie.
You're doing this deliberately.
The trouble is, Doctor Who has now become such an industry that they've had to look backwards to go forwards because it's such a fucking monster.
The problem is they've gone the Big Finish route and they handed it over to the fans.
Philip Hinchcliffe, no interest in Doctor Who, just a producer, took it on, made one of the best runs of the series we've ever had. I've always been in agreement with you on this, that it should be a non-fan producing television.
Or if it's going to be a fan, somebody who's a professional first and a fan second.
Yes, agreed. Peter Capaldi, David Tennant. Hey, having said that, though, both of those have made the two best doctors in the whole of New Who. So I'm not going to knock fans entirely, but I agree they have to be professionals first. So, yeah, a lot of doors open with the bi-generation thing. I think that it was gratuitous the way that there was the amount of flesh on show for the 15th Doctor. And even I've got to admit, he's a fine-looking man. So I think there were a lot of aroused viewers on both sides of the fence, done quite specifically.
And we'll see how that, I mean, presumably that can't, or could it?
It would be
a different style of Doctor. But, you know, is this massively different from the way that you were describing Matt Smith when he very first took on the role?
Yes, it is. Too young but he didn't act in, I mean, the whole thing about Matt Smith is, I know that you weren't overly struck, but he had that doctorish quality. Yes, he was a handsome young man, but he very much played it down for the most part. There was the odd cheeky wink and grin now and then, and hi, handsome, when he's talking to himself in the mirror. And having watched the trailer for the Christmas special and having seen the first 10 minutes of Shoot It Gatwa, I'm not convinced he's got the gravitas to pull this off. Now, please, 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 please prove me horrifically wrong.
First off, what I'd say is never judge how a doctor's going to be by their Christmas specials because they're always jokey.
Agreed. But my main worry is, oh, goodness me, I don't want this to be the Barry White Doctor. Hi, ladies. Hi, men. Hi, boys. I just don't want it to be the sexy Doctor because it's just not what I want from my Doctor Who. There's any number of heroes, if you want, on screen that fit that sexy superhero sweep in and save the day. And hi, girls. Hi, boys. I notice you're all getting a little bit tender for me. Yes, it's going to happen, but can we not have this billion-year-old Time Lord, that his primary appeal is not that he's a sex object. Can it not be that he's just this brilliant mind? That's my beef. I don't want a sexy Doctor. We've done that. We've bottomed it out. Please leave it alone. Move on. I don't think that's what we're going to get with Disney. I think we're going to get the sexy Doctor.
We'll see. And as long as it's not all that there is, I don't actually have a massive problem with that.
Oh, I do. Like I say, you're right, as long as that's not all that there is, but, oh, I'd really rather it wasn't there at all. If you can honestly say that you'd rather have the sexy, flirty, appeals to everyone, women and men fawning at his feet because they think that he's a bit hot, over any of the classic Doctors just thinking their way out of a problem.
But it doesn't have to be one or the other.
It doesn't, but I bet it is. I bet everywhere they bloody well land, there's somebody fawning over him. And it'll be men and women. And once you open that door, you can't bloody stop it.
Well, you can, because you have the whole Captain Jack thing, and that had its moment, and the Doctor had his flirtation with him, and it was all fun, and yes, isn't this jolly human stuff that you do, and then moved on with it. I think it's far too easy to say that this is going to be necessarily a problem.
Again, agreed. We've had 10 minutes of a Doctor and a trailer where he appears to be that Doctor. I hope that I'm proven wrong. My favourite Doctor is Peter Capaldi. This problem-solving alien that had this drive to find out. It was like Doctor Who used to be. That's why I love Capaldi. He doesn't fit the mould of the young swashbuckling hero, which is why, you know, he wasn't the most popular New Who Doctor.
And because he had a lot of fairly ropey stories.
Yeah, but if you look at, I mean, I've just been re-watching the 12th Doctor run. Got to Eater of Light last night. There's a reason I've not rewatched that one. It's dull. But a lot of the stories, actually, you watch them, they stand up very well. I mean, I know you're not a fan of The Caretaker for writer reasons, but it's bloody good. Mummy on the Orient Express, Dark Water, very good. The Christmas specials, with the exception of Last Christmas, which I don't particularly care for, the Christmas specials are all good. Series 10, I think, is great. That whole professor at university thing, brilliant. And his last story, there's not a hook to hang a hat on, but it's glorious. And his performance, even in the dull stories, is marvellous. So that's the sort of Doctor I want.
You don't yet know that that's the sort of Doctor you haven't got.
I don't, you're quite right. But my gut feeling, my first impressions were not amazing. And with pretty much all of the other Doctors, it has been, ooh. Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see. It is very unfair to judge. But overall, I would say a massively positive start to the new Russell T. Davis era. 14th Doctor's era has been lovely. 15th Doctor's era, I think, will be equally lovely. I have very high hopes for the show.
Yeah, so do I. I hope they bring back some names from the past. I hope it's more than just sort of token, oh yeah, we're bringing back Tegan for another episode, which doesn't really do very much. Because as lovely as it was to see Mel, she didn't actually do very much but just stand there and be the symbolic other handmaiden.
But she did actually do some computer work, which is her bloody character. It's far more than she got to do in the actual series.
And some dancing.
Yes!
I actually really loved that Spice Girls, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That he did. I thought that was camp nonsense and joyous.
Yeah, but sinister camp nonsense, rather than what we got with Power of the Doctor, where I like rah-rah Rasputin, I'm going to crowbar it in and leave it in there far too long. There was a sinister edge. This is what Russell T. Davis does. He takes popular songs, drops in 30 seconds worth, and it's sinister. And I love that little twist. He's done it 3 times now, at least, and I'm happy with that.
What's the third one?
Sound of Drums. There was, 4.
Yeah, I know Sound of Drums.
Soft Cell.
In what?
End of the World, where
Rose
just has a bit of a meltdown that she's surrounded by aliens. There's nobody human in the room, and she has, and it's just, yeah, actually, she's 5 billion miles from home, and there are no humans. She's complete. Everything about this is completely alien, and it just all hits by playing that song.
That wasn't Soft Cell. That was Britney Spears.
Soft Cell was in there as well. Toxic was played when the sun shield's coming down and she's about to be burned to death in that room.
But, it still wasn't a big song and dance number. It was this was called an iPod.
No, what I mean is that it was used in such a way where a perfectly innocuous track was used in such a way as incidental music to be horribly sinister. That was not the way Ra Ra Rasputin was used.
No, that was just horrible.
So overall, Are we positive about the future, Dr. Exton? Are we happy and filled with glee?
Absolutely. For all I've had my niggles about the three specials, and particularly the second one, I think it's very positive. If Russell T. Davies is just going to nick other people's plots, then I think I'd prefer him to find other people to write plots. But that might be what he's going to do going forward.
Yeah, I prefer they weren't recycled. I've always been slightly uncomfortable when, say, audios and novels have been repurposed as TV episodes wholesale. I've never been entirely fond of that. But as a one-off now, I didn't mind because I didn't realise, and I suppose that's probably the point, that the vast majority of viewers don't know that. My only hope for the future is that the, and I do hate the term, but wokery is toned down a little bit. I've no problem with it being dropped in there and as a subtext now and then, and a sort of moral values woven through the stories. No problem at all with that. Doctor Who has always done that. But just do it with a lighter hand.
I'm not quite as don't bother me with your problems as you are. But I do think that Rose's trans issues were overdone to the detriment of any other character development.
But on the whole, Dr. Exton and I are very, very positive about the future. It's been a wonderful... Woo-hoo. Oh, woohoo indeed. It has been a wonderful rebirth of the show. Here's to the future.
Before we leave, we have one final person to talk to.
Oh, God.
Siri?
I am Persian.
Name your price.
Siri Van Ebb. What, my dear, do you think about the drag queen index? How many Olvias are we going to give this out of 5?
Well, I'm not going to do it episode by episode. We'll do all 3 at once. And I think it's going to be a 5 for the toy maker on his own. And that's that whole Spice Girls medley thing with him flouncing about dressed up as a Nutcracker character.
Would you like to zig-a-zig harvest me, Herr Doctor?
But what else was there? Nobody really had any particularly flouncily or overly feminine outfits. I think Woman at British Home Stores sums up pretty much every female costume in this.
You're a harsh man, Dr. X.
Who was there? Donna and her multi-purpose jumper, Sylvia and her lovely cardi, Rose and her by-the-numbers teenager outfit chosen by gay blokes who won't have been under the age of 40. Kate Lethbridge-Stewart in her combat business wear. Mel in the desperately trying to claw the last bit of the 80s padded shoulder jacket. There is some resting bitch face, but actually it's just not particularly engaged acting. There's no massively OTT makeup on any of the women. Okay, there is on the Toymaker. I think the Toymaker by himself pushes this into being a 5. If it weren't for him, it would be a 2.
Well, there you go.
The thing that we haven't mentioned is the god himself, Bernard Cribbins.
Oh, Lord Bernard of the Cribbins.
It was a joy to see him.
Bernard Cribbins in his final acting performance. And for all 3 minutes that he was on screen, the audience was crying inside by how beautiful the man was. Oh, God damn. It's such a shame we didn't get more of him. That one scene, it was worth it. It was worth it just to see him again.
Again, the final scene with the moles.
Love the moles. A kiss back to Born Again.
But just better off without. Why did they have to mention him? He wasn't living there at the time. They could have just glossed over it.
Yes, I can see that it would have probably been better to have left him where he was, but narratively they had to explain why he wasn't in the scene. Well, they didn't have to, but it was a nice little kiss as to why he wasn't in the scene. Would it have been better without? Maybe, but I've got to admit I did get a little tingle that it was in there. So there's arguments for and against, but we at least got Bernard Cribbins for one last hurrah, and I couldn't give a toss after that.
And I don't have a terrible ante on it, to be perfectly honest.
But it was lovely, wasn't it?
It was.
And on that tear-jerking, heartbreaking note, raising a glass to the man Bernard Cribbins. There's just no words. If you don't know who Bernard Cribbins is or why he's so beloved, go out.
Then why are you listening to us?
Why are you listening to us, you strange people? Thank you very much for staying the course with us. We hope that you are loving the ride as much as we are. We'll see you soon.
Bye now.
The Exton Moss Experiment featured Simon Exton and Ken Moss. All featured soundtracks are the property of their respective producers, and no infringement of copyright is intended. Title music was performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and the programme was produced by Maverick Productions. For more information, please visit maverickproductionsuk.blogspot.com or find us on social media.